This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It is Wednesday, time to talk about your health. And we'll begin with the latest cancer screening controversy. So a federally appointed body called the Canadian Task Force on Preventive Health issues those guidelines. And now another group of medical experts is calling some of those guidelines dangerous and outdated. For instance, the first task force recommends mammograms starting at the age of 50, while some provinces and some people believe 40 is a better time to start. So we'll dig into that. And here's a story where medicine intersects with the law. Some pharmacists who own Shoppers Drug Mart franchises want their suit against Shoppers Corporate to be certified as a class action. They allege that head office has been coercing them to push unnecessary services that they can bill OHIP, hence taxpayers, for. For instance, MedCheck, where a pharmacist checks the medication a patient is on to see if there are possible interactions or whether they are even still necessary. So who actually needs to have this service and how often should it be done? The numbers to call, 416-360-0740. Toll free 1-866-740-4740. Both those questions, cancer screening, mammograms, when did you start? Did it find anything? What do you think? And also this question of the meds check. It depends on how many medications are you on and how often have you had the pharmacist do a meds check, and was it really necessary? And we'll hear from you before we hear from the panel.
Now, time for The Medical Record.
And let's bring in Dr. Malcolm Moore, medical oncologist at Princess Margaret, former head of the BC Cancer Agency, Dr. Fahad Razak, Canada Research Chair in Data-Informed Healthcare Improvement at the University of Toronto, and Dr. Elisa Naiman, family physician and founder and medical director of the Medical Station in Toronto. Hello and welcome to you all.
Good morning.
Hi, Libby.
Hi. So let's start with the latest controversy on screening and the age to start screening. We'll begin with Dr. Moore. What do you think, 50 or 40?
Okay, so this is a very interesting issue. And honestly, it's less about cancer screening than it is about the development of health policy. And I'll be interested to hear what Fahad and Alicia have to say on this topic. But every Western country has something like the Canadian Task Force, which is a group of people who are charged with developing recommendations around population-based screening programs. And we have the Canadian Task Force. This is a highly credible group. If you look at all of the high-quality cancer websites, that when they talk about cancer screening, they always refer to the U.S. Preventative Task Force, the Canadian Task Force, the Australian, and the U.K. So it's a very credible group. If you want to know about them, they have a website. The 15 people who are on it are identified. They've all got clear conflict of interest statements. And what they try to do is look at the evidence and come up with some general recommendations around what sort of screening the evidence supports. And the challenge often is that opinion can be different than evidence. So this group sifts through the evidence, and I think Fahad's group actually provides some support in terms of these evidence reviews. So it's a very credible group. On the other hand, if you look at this coalition of healthcare screening group and go to their website, it's very unclear who they are, how they're funded. They haven't done any specific work or evidence reviews of screening, and it's much more of an advocacy group. And the challenge with that, honestly, is that if you make a change in a recommendation about screening, there can be people who can benefit economically for that. If we expand screening for breast cancer to 40, that means more tests, more radiologists get to read those tests, more clinics get to make money, the companies who make the screening machines make money. So you have to be very careful about conflict of interest. So I'm not saying that this coalition is conflicted, but it's very unclear what their funding is and what their agenda is. But the one thing I would say that they do have a point about is that typically these organizations only revise their screening guidelines about every 5 or 6 years. And I think as new technologies have come online and as a lot more evidence comes up about targeted screening, we probably need to do these reviews more frequently. So I would agree with that piece. But I think to call this deplorable or dangerous is really, that's inappropriate language for a bunch of people who are doing this out of the goodness of their heart. They're not even paid. They have full-time jobs working in the system, and they're trying to provide advice that's good for the population, good for the public.
So before we move on to Fahad, there have been a lot of doctors in the States that say that the age should be dropped to 40 because I guess more younger women are being diagnosed with breast cancer. Now, on the other hand, there are harms to too much screening. There are a lot of false positives, sometimes unnecessary biopsies. And it's also depends on how you look at the results. I mean, I just on Zoomer Weekend Review did an interview with a guy named David Ropeek, who wrote a book called Curing Cancer Phobia. Now, I've seen very different statistics on the result of breast cancer screening, but according to his number, he says that 2,000 women have to be screened for 10 years in order to prevent one death. And that's obviously on a population level. And this screening is for people at average risk. I mean, people who are identified at high risk obviously have more screening. So Fahad, take it away.
Yeah, look, I think Malcolm's answer was honestly quite perfect in where I would land on this issue. I don't know any people on the federal task force. I don't know any people interviewed in this article. So I'd like to say I'm approaching this without bias about who's right or who's wrong. And he's exactly right. The article starts with really honestly inflammatory language that is attacking colleagues, but also in many ways, I think scaring the public using words, as he said, like dangerous and deplorable about, you know, a volunteer body that's trying to interpret evidence and provide best care for Canada. Look, certainly guidelines need to be updated faster, as he said. The resources that these bodies have mean that they are on update cycles of, you know, 5-year update cycles, which the way evidence is changing. We've covered on your show this remarkable transformation, for example, with HPV screening as this remarkable method of identifying the strains of virus that are going to cause cancers down the road for women. This is a finding where the evidence is quite new about how effective it is. If these guidelines wait 5 years, it could be too long. That said, some of the people interviewed in this article point to the U.S. and say, look, the U.S. is changing faster. If you go to the U.S. website of their preventative task force, they say on their website that their screening guidelines for women are under review. They do have preliminary recommendations. They have in their preliminary recommendations say start at age 40, but they haven't even finalized their guidelines yet. And so to say that we are dramatically behind what's happening in the US, I don't think is the case. The point about conflicts of interest is really important. You know, it's interesting, if you Google my name, one of the first things that comes up is my conflict of interest statement, because if you sit in these bodies where you're making recommendations that will affect millions of people in the country, and you are potentially going to cost the taxpayers hundreds of thousands, millions and millions of dollars, it does matter how you make your own money, who pays you. These things are very important. And you see, for one body, clear conflict of interest declarations. You can look on every single person if they've had income from any of these funding bodies, if they've ever made money off of things that are related to the guidance they're giving. For the other group, no conflict of interest provided. And so it is, to me, when I look at this, I see one body which, again, I'm not an expert on whether it should be 40 or 50. It looks like breast cancer screening is going to shift towards their 40s, at least in the United States, maybe in Canada. But to me, the bigger question here, as Malcolm raised, is how do we put these guidelines together? And again, I want to emphasize, on the medical side, screening is not without risk. When we screen, you may say, well, what's the harm in screening women in their 40s and 50s? Well, I would say then, why not start in their 20s? Why not start in their 30s? I mean, you can just keep pushing this number lower and lower. And the reason why we don't, of course, is because you could potentially tell thousands and thousands of women that they have something that's risky for every one case of something actually risky that you find. And as you push that number lower and lower, that's the problem.
I mean, imaging is getting better, but I think the number was 25% of all women get a call back saying, I see something I don't like and we have to repeat the mammogram. Those are stressful. I mean, you know, the stress of getting a call back doesn't compare to a diagnosis of breast cancer, but that is one of the harms. And Elisa, I mean, one of the things I read from this group was that it confuses doctors about when to screen. But if doctors know that someone is at high risk, they can screen them. I mean, I started getting screening long before the age of 50. And at the end, you know, I found the breast cancer with a lump in between screens.
Yes. So you're completely right. So, as part of my job, on a yearly basis, I review with my patients whether or not there's any changes to their family history. That would then change what their risk would be. And if somebody has multiple people in their family or somebody who gets diagnosed at a certain age, then that changes the conversation compared to somebody who's an average risk patient. But what I start to do, and I'll be honest that over the course of my career, in terms of how I've approached screening to mammogram, has changed with the evidence. And, you know, everybody will come in and will tell me a story of some young person who has cancer and how they're afraid. And I like to take the approach that if somebody is of average risk and they're somewhere in their 40s, that we have a conversation and it's a joint decision-making decision in terms of whether or not somebody wants to be screened. And one of the big things that I'm counseling women on is that the very first time you go, there is a very high chance that you're going to get recalled. You're going to be waiting a couple weeks to go back for your appointment. You're going to think you have cancer, and you need to be aware that this is going to be a stressful time. And oftentimes, you know, they find things. The imaging is so good that lots of things are picked up, and it forces people to go back for further imaging at the time. They might be going for imaging in 6 months. They might be going imaging in a year. And I think people have to understand the pros and cons of going for when you would start to screen for a mammogram. And often people will say, I'm okay, I'm going to wait. And I'm like, okay, we'll have this conversation again in a year and we'll make a decision then. And some people are like, this really stresses me out and I really want to go. I understand. Please send the referral.
Do you have an opinion about whether mass screening should start at 40 instead of 50?
So it's very interesting. If you ask me on an individual level and in conversations with patients, everybody will get mad at me on the panel, but I probably would not prevent somebody who wants to go for a mammogram at 40. Listen, I just had somebody who came to see me a couple of months ago, and we had this conversation, and she's 41, and she actually has breast cancer, and she's having chemotherapy now before she can have surgery, and it sounds like it's a quite an aggressive form of breast cancer. And I said to her when she got this diagnosis, can you imagine that we just had this conversation and we decided to have you go to do it? And she was grateful that we did this, and now she has this diagnosis and has to go through everything. But it really has changed, and, you know, this guideline that they're talking about now, the revision was supposed to come out in the fall, and they said, the task force said that there's a lot of information that has to be reviewed, and now it's coming out in the spring, and so we'll see. But the same thing with the cervical guidelines. The cervical guidelines are from 2013. A lot has changed since 2013, and these guidelines really should be updated. And then also there's Cancer Care Ontario has guidelines. So the guidelines, you know, I think the government has said that for people that they're going to be dropping the screening down to 40 in the fall. The Ontario government said that, and they're in the process now of changing the guideline for pap smears starting at the age of 25. And there's been no discussion or nothing has been given to us family doctors working in the community in terms of what will be happening with HPV DNA testing. So there is a lag, and I think that it needs to be caught up, and I think, you know, people should have access to care if they want it, but it becomes a conversation that right now people need to have with their practitioner.
Well, which reminds me, the biggest issue in healthcare, of course, is the lack of family doctors. And it's one thing if they have a doctor like you, Dr. Naaman, and they have that conversation every year, but if they don't have a family doctor, that's a whole other conundrum. So I guess we'll wait to see what happens with these guidelines. The controversy persists. I've been covering dips and bits of it for years. So we'll see what happens, whether screening goes down to 40. Moving right along to this very interesting Shoppers Drug Mart story. So some pharmacists want a lawsuit certified as a class action lawsuit, and they've been alleging, sometimes anonymously, that they are under a lot of pressure to push some of these meds check and whatever else a pharmacist can get reimbursed for by Shoppers Corporate in order to make more money. Fahd Razak, what do you make of that story?
Yeah, it was interesting to read this, and it mirrors a phenomena that is very well documented in clinical practice. Specifically, this has been shown over and over again in physician billings to the government, where if you have something that remunerates an additional amount, let's say to do an extra test like an ECG, in this case, the example is to do this medication review, you'll suddenly, in certain circumstances, have a surge in the use of that additional process, whether it's, you know, screening or a test, for example. And it really highlights the need to regulate or have some oversight process about appropriateness. And it's not that an ECG is not a critical technology. Of course it is. And in this case, medication review in the context of the Canadian population, where we have an aging population, the use of medications is increasingly sophisticated. We describe the phenomena of our older patients, many of our older patients being on many medications now as polypharmacy, i.e. many medications. And when I'm reviewing an admission to hospital, it's not surprising that I go through with my residents and just marvel that, you know, we have an 80-year-old who's on 20 medications, and some of them are multiple drugs a day. And we just think, imagine the burden of having to take all of these medications and how many of these are necessary. And the role of a pharmacist in helping to clean up that list and to say, well, your cardiologist prescribed this and your family doctor prescribed this, and maybe we can consolidate that and just simplify your life a little bit, lower your side effects. They are experts in medication prescribing. So there's clearly a role in them helping in this process. But if you have then this overlay of profit, it starts to muddy the water. And this is where, and again, these are allegations, but I don't think this has gone to court yet. This is a class action lawsuit that's starting. If there's a corporate pressure to increase the use of these screening of these medication screens simply because they remunerate, the pharmacy makes more money, and then of course corporate gets a greater cut of that money, that's clearly a problem. And there is also, I should say, from medicine, there is a way to deal with this, which is appropriateness guidelines. And that's what's clearly probably could address this, where you have something that could be valuable to many people, but if used in excess, could slide into the situation where you're just milking the taxpayer.
Okay, so Dr. Moore, I mean, off the top of your head, is there, excuse me, a guideline in terms of how many medications a patient should be on to need this, and also how often it has to happen? There were some stories in there that a patient was prescribed something, and then they noticed that they got like a med check for it without even being told about it.
Well, I think the issue here, and I think Fahad covered it nicely, is that the way the government chooses to fund the system will manipulate how the system operates. And so if you start to reimburse certain activities, then those are more likely to be done. And you can use that in a positive way to get people to do things which are desirable, but people also may take advantage of that. And this actually factors into some of the many discussions we've had about family medicine, which is if you fund family doctors based on how many patients they see, you get one thing. If you put them on a salary, which allows them to spend more time with patients, you get different types of behavior. This is just a feature of our healthcare system. That said, it's pretty difficult to get into what's an appropriate medication review, because as Fahad said, lots of older people are on lots of medications, and there probably is some value to doing this. It's just that if the only purpose of it being done is to make money, then that doesn't really meet your expectations in terms of what useful activity is.
Dr. Naiman, what's your take on this?
Oh, Libby, I have a lot to say.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so I will say this. So it's my understanding that a meds check can be done if somebody is on at least three medications. And what my colleagues have said is completely true. There's a lot of value in doing a meds review, and people have polypharmacy, and reviews of medications should happen so that people aren't taking as many medications. But that's not what's happening. What's happening is that I have people in their 20s who are on topical acne medication who are getting meds reviews. I'll give you an example of something that came in yesterday. I had an appointment with a patient who was put on metformin, and she developed GI side effects. She wasn't able to tolerate it. She had really bad diarrhea, and she's on this med. And so we switched her to Ozempic because she's on it for weight loss. So I sent in the prescription to the pharmacy, a Shoppers, by the way. And what happened was I discontinued the metformin and I started the Ozempic because we couldn't start the Ozempic before because there was a shortage. And guess what? I got a med review back for two medications, which I just told you everybody that it's three medications. And what was written was no changes necessary, and that called patient when received new prescription, patient said had GI side effects and advised them to go ahead with the Ozempic. That's $75. That is a complete waste of money. And this happens on an ongoing basis. Rarely do I ever get a meds check that actually something needs to be done. There was one time I can remember somebody who was on an osteoporosis medication that the pharmacist did an amazing job and explained why the patient was having side effects to the medications because of a lactose intolerance in the filler. And other than that, I really can't say that there has ever been a meds check that has been helpful. And I have patients who are pharmacists who work at Shoppers. I have patients who are the owner of the Shoppers, and everybody will tell me of the pressure that they have to complete these meds checks. And this is a complete waste of money. The government needs to stop this. And what is very interesting is that I never see a meds check from a pharmacy that is an independent pharmacist. It is always from Shoppers, sometimes from Rexall, but 95% of them, they're from Shoppers. And this really needs to stop. It's a waste of healthcare dollars, and it's a waste of the time for me to be reviewing all of these things. As part of my visits with patients, we are to review medications, and it is quite upsetting that a pharmacist will even call the patient with their client without even them knowing, and then they bill $75. So this is not what the intended consequences of it is, and things need to change.
Wow. Okay, thanks. I'm going to take a call from Ron in Guelph. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Libby. I just spoke with my son in Montreal, and what is happening in Ontario, I don't know about the other province, but in Quebec, it can't happen because the pharmacist is an independent person. PharmaPrix is part of Shoppers Drug Mart, correct?
Yes.
PharmaPrix has no say over what happens with the pharmacist. He owns his portion of the pharmacy, and all the rest of the stuff is not part of him. They're not his boss, so they can't tell the pharmacist at the PharmaPrix what to do or how to run his business.
I have to check that, because the pharmacists own they also own the stores, right? But they're franchisees. So I can't comment. I haven't checked into the ownership structure, but it might be what the government says. But Ron, thanks for that.
Yeah.
Sorry. do either Malcolm Moore or Fahad Razak want to respond to what Dr. Naaman said before we wrap up?
I thought just that say was briefly, really fascinating to hear Elisa's perspective on this. You know, I inhabit the in-hospital space, and I see a very different spectrum. And look, the example she raised of acne treatment, undergoing an intensive review, this is clearly the kind of use of the code of this MedCheck review code for money rather than to actually advance patient well-being. I see things on the flip side in hospital where I regularly rely on my pharmacy colleagues to sort through extremely complicated medication regimes where I mentioned, you know, lots of medications, lots of different timing, interactions between them. I would hope that there'd be a way to extend out that capacity to family doctors, primary care outside of the hospital, because it's very, very useful. But you clearly have to be worried about the examples that Elisa is giving.
Okay, we're almost out of time. Malcolm, last word to you on this.
I thought that was a very enlightening answer by Alicia, and it shows you the value of getting different perspectives on these health issues from family practice and specialists. And I think what she said was, I think, a clear violation of the intent of these medication reviews.
Yeah. Anyway, we will be watching see what happens with that court case, and it's a good thing that these pharmacists basically had the nerve to take this public, because I would imagine that it's not that easy to take on Shoppers Corporate. Anyway, on that note, I'm going to wrap things up. Thank you so much, Dr. Elisa Naaman, Dr. Malcolm Moore, and Dr. Fahad Razak. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
Okay, we are taking a break, and when we come back, well, what did you think about yesterday's budget? Did it help you? Did it help your kids or your grandkids? It was designed to be a good thing for younger generations. And of course, we will have some expert panelists, including one of the co-founders of The Peak, which is one of the journalistic newsletters that we own. And they are, of course, younger than we are. And we'll talk about their perspective when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. The selling of yesterday's budget, which featured $54.5 billion in new spending, well, it's well underway. The Prime Minister delivered a campaign-style speech, and the opposition is trashing the government's economic blueprint. It was designed to appeal to the younger generations, millennials and Gen Z, and to give them what the liberals are calling generational fairness. So, are those younger voters biting? now that the polls show that they are abandoning the Liberal Party en masse in favor of the Conservatives. So I'd like to hear from you. Also, the older demographic, CARP, doesn't think there's very much in there for the older demographic, the demographic that votes in very high percentages. The numbers, 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740. And now let's go to Taylor Scullin, co-founder of The Peak, Muhammad Ali, a liberal strategist and senior consultant at Crestview Strategy in Ottawa, John McEtishan, conservative activist and political consultant and president of the Bradgate Research Group. Hi, all. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, love to be with you.
Let us begin with Taylor, our designated young person. So what did you think? It wasn't just what was in the budget. I mean, it was released on a roadshow over quite a while.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, much of what was in there that I think is relevant to young people has been announced over the past couple weeks. I think it's good to see the movement finally on housing, especially, and ramping up the supply of new housing. I think there was some good stuff in there that's promising. Changing some of the tax rules around rental apartments, I think, will be good. The question I would have is any of this actually going to bear fruit for the government in their current term in office? And I guess, I would leave that to the political strategist. But on a substance level, I think there were some promising things.
Okay. John McEtishan, what did you think?
Interesting, desperate final or second final budget by a government that is committed to people in the banking industry, giving them more money than ever before, and really doesn't serve anybody. And I don't think this at the end of the day is going to appeal to anybody, because most people know that when the bulk of this budget is supposed to actually take effect, the Liberals will already be out of office.
Well, that remains to be seen. I guess the point of the budget was to try to prevent that from happening, Mohammed.
Yeah, look, this budget was designed entirely for, or mostly entirely for, the millennial and Gen Z population. I mean, the millennials were the ones who helped catapult Justin Trudeau to a majority government in 2015. And many of those people who were there early to mid-20s are now in their 30s now, who are trying to start a family, trying to get to the next level of their careers, buy a house. And so very much targeted towards bringing them back into the Liberal tent to reactivate that energy that they have with them, as they're now the largest voting bloc as well from a millennial's perspective. So I think this budget, well, yes, there are some things that are going to take years to build. If we just thought about what's going to be built tomorrow, I don't think nothing would ever get done. But there are some measures that really are going to gear to help, de-risk investments for home construction, right? They're taking up the GST rebates for student housing being developed on campuses and such. There are all these other components. That's a pretty comprehensive housing plan. And I think it needs to be given a little bit of credit that this is pretty robust. We could make the argument it should have been done 5 years ago, maybe, or 6 years ago to be prepared. But look, we're in a crisis now, and this government is responding. And I think they made it very clear with the pretty comprehensive housing plan.
Taylor, from your point of view, the point of view of your circle of friends and colleagues, do you think this will accomplish what the Liberals want, which is to make people in your demographic vote for them?
I have to be honest, until rents start coming down, until home prices start being more affordable for people, I really don't see them tuning into what the Prime Minister is saying. And, I'm not going to comment on whether that's fair or not, but I think that's the reality. This has come very late in this government. And for a lot of people, I think they've stopped listening.
Pierre Poilievre, the Conservative leader, started talking about housing and affordability a long time ago. Is that why you think the younger demos are attracted to him?
I'm not sure if it's an attraction to him personally, or if it's an aversion to the status quo, and he is sort of just the main alternative at hand right now. I'm not sure, but you know, I think the housing issue certainly resonates with people, and I think he's been well served by talking about it amongst younger voters, certainly.
John McEtishan, I mean, there's a lot of speculation about what Jagmeet Singh is going to do. He was not very happy with the budget, but I'm pretty sure he's going to vote for it.
Yeah, I mean, he's in a very tough place. He's painted himself into a corner. He has to support the government. He has to support the budget. It's almost as if, you know, his greatest wish came true and, you know, he's a virtual partner with the prime minister, but he gets none of the credit for the good things. And he takes all the heat for the bad things. So, you know, his unhappiness is not going to end until after the next election.
Mm-hmm. And Mohammed, I'm sure that they came up with these budget measures and focus groups and whatnot, but what's your reaction to what Taylor had to say, that probably that demo won't even tune in until they see something concrete improving?
I think that's a totally fair comment. I think that's why his budget was designed the way it was, that they need to bring them back. They need to earn back that support, that vote, and action needs to be, you know, to Taylor's point, rent has to come down, has it to be more affordable. So execution is the big thing here. They did a good job communicating what they will do now in the last 2 weeks and including this budget, but now they'll need to really, you know, act fast over the next, you know, 16 to 18 months until the next election to see, is there actually any progress being made? Is there any light at the end of the tunnel? I think that's what they have laid out, a plan and a path forward for that. And also they're looking to not leave any stone unturned. They're going to be activating a lot of unused government lands that have historically not been used for housing. They've streamlined housing builds. They're going to pump up more modular homes. So, you know, I think they're looking at everything possible. So, you know, hopefully for the sake of the country that there is progress and there's some action and some relief for folks like Taylor and others that are looking to find an affordable place to live in any city and town they want to. So,
I mean, one of the classic things about this Liberal government is that they announce a lot, but you have to reelect them at least once or twice if you want the check in the mail or otherwise. John, I mean, a lot of the things that they are announcing, first of all, they need buy-in from the provinces. It's not their jurisdiction. And the money is going to come in further years. And for instance, something that most people want, the new disability benefit, I mean, was passed into law last summer, and it won't even start for another year.
Libby, I can tell you I recently got a new pair of glasses, and I didn't get any help from the federal government there. I just went to my dentist for the annual checkup. I thought this was free. I thought the prime minister already promised me free dental. I didn't get that free. There is that reality. One of the other panelists said, you know, it sounds good, but when they go to buy their groceries, when they go to put gas in the tank, and, you know, if every wish that the Liberals have laid out here for housing bears fruit, and it has not been their record, but if it all bears fruit, you won't actually see houses and new condos and other apartments being built for years. And most people don't believe that any of this stuff is going to have the impetus that it wants. So the reality and the hard part for the Liberals is people every day are seeing the effects of their bad policies, like the carbon tax, and they feel it when they get their groceries. And what got reinforced in the budget is that interest rates aren't going down because the federal government's going to keep on competing for the money there. So it's you know, the pain is daily under the Liberal government, and all their promised relief, if it were to bear fruit, won't be for years.
Speaking of the carbon tax, Taylor Scollin, I would assume that most younger people are perhaps in favor of it, and those rebates landed in people's bank accounts. Yesterday, I know I asked my husband, he got $183.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I'm not sure what the sentiment around that is. I mean, young people generally want to see action on climate. I'm not sure that there's a firm commitment to the carbon tax as the only mechanism to accomplish that. But yeah, I suspect that it's viewed more favorably among younger demographics than, you know, the relative population. But this has turned into a real albatross for the government, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I still don't understand how a tax actually gives you more money, but it depends, you know, what kind of an economic bracket you're in. And John, I found it very interesting that Jagmeet Singh backed off support for having a carbon tax for regular folks.
Well, if you go by what we all believe the demographics are supposed to be, right, the NDP is the party of the working class. Those are the, you know, working class and poor. Those are the people who are feeling this the most, because they don't have any extra money for tax. You know, a generational thing I was going to point out is this, the liberals are now saying a 30-year mortgage is a great thing. Look at that. We're going to allow you to be in debt for another 5 years. And you know, what they're doing is teaching people to be more impoverished and waste their money, because anybody with half a brain knows that one of the ways you can build wealth and cut your expenses long term is to have as short as amortization as possible, which the bigger thing would be to get interest rates down. But instead, they're dedicated not only to the carbon taxes we have today, but people should look at how much they're looking at raising them over the next 5 to 6 years if they were to get reelected.
Mohammed, what about this feeling among some older people that the Liberals are abandoning them? You know, it was surprising that a lot of older folks who you would think would have a natural kind of conservative bent, well, a lot of them supported Justin Trudeau. And if he loses them, you know, that's not very good.
Yeah, look, I don't think they completely abandoned them, if that's the sentiment. I mean, they did do more, they reinforced the old age security at 65. They could have changed to 67 if they really didn't, you know, as there's been pressure to push them to go up there. They've been topping up, you know, the old age security GIS as well for previously.
Only for people 75.
Yeah, I think the important thing, though, for those who are seniors, that like this government has been kind of consistent on some of the support for seniors throughout. And in fact, that's what precipitated that they needed to do a better job addressing the millennials and Gen Z population, because what that demographic is challenged with today is a little bit different than what the, you know, the baby boomers and the Gen X populations are going through, right? So the sort of shift, and it's tough in any environment that to do everything for everyone and you risk doing nothing, right, if you spread yourself so thin. So I think the way to take away for this budget is, while it may not have a huge amount towards, you know, the seniors population, it hasn't taken away anything, right? I think that could have been very much at risk if something was being taken away, and it wasn't. It was reinforced, and we can expect something probably in the next year, given as we're coming to an election, where they will reinforce what they have done for seniors to date.
Well, that's a whole new way of looking at things, celebrating not having things taken away. Anyway, on that note, we wrap things up. Thanks so much, Mohammed Ali, Taylor Scollin, and John Mikitishan. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Thanks, Libby. Bye. Bye.
Okay, we are going to take a break. And when we come back, what's going on south of the border? The historic Donald Trump hush money trial has begun. We'll check in and see where that's at. And a lot of people, even here in Canada, have a lot to say about Donald Trump. So let me give the numbers again before we go to break. 416-360-0740. Toll free 1-866-740-4740. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Have you been watching the trial of Donald Trump, or at least the wind-up pitch to it? What do you think? 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-744-7440. Well, it is a day off in the trial, and that's a good time to check in and see where things are at. He, of course, is the first U.S. president to be charged with a felony, 34 of them to be exact, in this case that revolves around the hush money he allegedly paid to porn star Stormy Daniels. Well, seven jurors have been chosen, and this amid questions about whether it was even possible to find impartial jurors in New York. So what do you think? Joining me now, Dr. Chris Cooper, a political science professor at Western Carolina University. Dr. Cooper, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, so far, all we've seen is this jury selection, which the expectation was that it would be very hard. New Yorkers generally, of course, hate Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I think we're all waiting to see how long this would take. Could you find anybody who would be acceptable to Trump? Could you find anybody who said they didn't know much? And it turns out one of these jurors they selected said she had been, by a lake for essentially the whole last year, away from internet connection completely. So that's the kind of person you have to find who doesn't have an opinion one way or the other already about Donald Trump, Stormy Daniels, and really this entire trial.
Mm-hmm. But they managed to find seven people.
That's right. No, they absolutely did. It appears that a few of them Trump wanted to get rid of because of social media posts, right? People had already kind of weighed in on social media with their opinion. The Trump team said no. But yeah, they've got seven. I mean, you referred to this before as an opening pitch. I kind of like that. I think the other way to look at it, though, would be we still haven't even really gotten to the opening pitch. Right now, we're just trying to figure out who's in the starting lineup, who's actually going to be playing this game.
It was interesting. I mean, normally, I guess, judges don't excuse jurors just because they say they know something about it and they have an opinion. They have a little chat. But in this case, I guess he's trying to avoid a mistrial.
Yeah, I think he's trying to avoid a mistrial. Look, the judge clearly knows that not just America, but as our conversation today attests, the entire world is watching this trial. So, look, the judge is no fool. He knows that. He knows that he's being judged not just by the law, but also in the court of public opinion right now. By he, I mean both Donald Trump and the judge himself. So we have some jurors that have been taken oath so far, have been sworn in. We'll get to opening statements before too terribly long, but it also looks like another kind of interesting thing. Donald Trump already got admonished by the judge, so evidently one of these jurors kind of got into a little verbal tiff with Trump right there at the trial before things even really got going.
But he gets admonished by judges, it seems like, every other day. Nothing ever happens.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In terms of the court of public opinion, look, we already know, if you're a listener to this program, you almost certainly know what you think about Donald Trump already. The idea that we're going to learn anything new in this trial, I think is a little bit far-fetched. So there's a sort of prominent election scholar named Rick Hasen out at UCLA, and he's kind of made the point that this trial is kind of the least interesting one, that it's a tough case to make, and even if he's found guilty, essentially the thing he would be found guilty of, although perhaps ethically more than dubious, legally, would kind of get him a slap on the wrist. Essentially, he didn't fill out some paperwork that said that this was part of his campaign, and that's unlikely to be the kind of thing that changes the outcome of the election. Now, the Jack Smith case, I think that could be something, the Washington, D.C. case could be something different, and the Georgia election overturning case, of course, could also be something very, very different.
That's right. So he is facing, four trials? And there's a feeling that this one is the weakest one.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think in terms of the evidence, what they need to show, what the prosecution's going to try to show, is that Donald Trump paid hush money to Stormy Daniels to hide this affair or this sexual experience they had together. I don't think anybody doubts that.
Which he denies, by the way.
That's exactly right. And I think most of us have a feeling that probably happened, right? I think the evidence is pretty good there. The turn, though, that the prosecution needs to make here is they need to say that that was election-related, that by paying that money and not disclosing it on Federal Election Commission documents, that they're somehow violating this campaign finance law. That's at least part of this case. If you had a hard time following that, I don't blame you, right? It just doesn't sound like that big of a crime compared to, I don't know, let's say trying to overthrow the United States government as he did on January 6th.
Well, yeah. And also, apparently, the judge is compelling him to be there every day of the trial, which means he can't campaign on those days. So, I mean, I would imagine that his supporters are eating that up.
Oh, absolutely, they're eating that up. I mean, this is in some ways free publicity for Donald Trump. Again, we're not going to learn a lot, right? I mean, I think what we're going to learn in this trial is that Donald Trump is ethically dubious, that Donald Trump has, over time, cheated on his current wife, cheated on his past wives, kind of does that as a course of business, and that he will be happy to bribe somebody to protect his reputation. You didn't learn anything from what the sentences I just said. I don't think we're going to learn much in this trial. So his supporters get to just use this as another example of what they will perceive as Trump being persecuted, right? I mean, he will be able to play the martyr very, very well on a daily basis.
I believe that this is likely to be the only one of those trials that will actually get to court before the next election. Is that right?
Yeah, that is exactly right. It seems like, I mean, there is an outside chance we might get another before the election, but I think most likely this is the only one we are certain will be heard before the election. So it's possible that this is the only one that's going to happen before Americans make this big decision come November, and really with early voting in lots of our country, come October when we actually start casting these votes. So yes, this will likely be the one before the election. If he wins, we're going to be in this very, very unusual situation then. He would then, of course, be the president of the United States and would presumably be immune to these charges. And so they would presumably then have to hold off for another 4 years. It's incredibly confusing, and it really is uncharted territory to figure out what this would look like if he wins, but also if he loses.
Well, he's not going to accept a loss. He said that already. What should we be looking for in the days ahead? And do you think it will have any impact on the outcome of that election?
Yeah, I don't think this trial is likely to have much of an outcome of any sort of real influence on the outcome of this election. This is pretty much a coin toss election. I think it's going to remain a coin toss election. In other words, I think Trump and Biden have roughly equal odds to win when you consider the Electoral College. So I don't think it's going to matter that much. Now, you know, what should people be watching for? I mean, you should be watching all of it. This is it's incredibly consequential who becomes the next president of the United States, whether you live south of the border, or north of the border, or whether you live in a different continent entirely. So I think it all really matters as far as what's going to affect the outcome. Any new information, I mean, if we really do learn something new about Donald Trump that he did, something negative that we didn't see coming, I think that might have an impact. If one of these other trials somehow moves forward, perhaps that would have an impact. As far as the hush money one, I just don't see it having a big electoral impact.
Okay. Thank you so much for that, Dr. Chris Cooper. And that's all the time we have for today. Jane Brown will be in the chair tomorrow. We'll be back on Friday.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.